Imagine like showing up for your first day of college, but instead of picking up a syllabus or finding your dorm room, you are pointed toward a narrow, unrailed stone bridge, and it's suspended hundreds of feet in the air.
Yeah, not your typical campus tour.
Right. The wind is howling, the stone is slick with rain, and your instructions are just, well, simple. Cross it. And if you slip, you don't just, fail orientation, you literally plummet to your death. So, welcome to the Bastiath War College.
It is a brutally effective filter. It's designed to establish the absolute life or death stakes of this world before a single class is even taken. And I mean, it perfectly encapsulates why millions of readers are just currently obsessed with this universe.
Oh, totally. We are talking, of course, about Rebecca Yarros's massive, like 2,400-page romantasy juggernaut, the Empyrean series.
Yes, which includes Fourth Wing, Iron Flame, and the latest installment that literally has everyone reeling right now, Onyx Storm.
So whether you are, trying to understand why your friends are having frantic debates at coffee shops about dragons and lightning, or maybe you're just prepping to dominate a pop culture trivia night, you are in the right place.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are taking a comprehensive trivia cram sheet for this massive series, and, well, we're breaking it all down.
Yeah, we won't just be reading you a list of dates and fantasy names to memorize because that gets boring. The goal today is to examine the underlying architecture of this story. We want to understand how the lore, the complex magic systems, and those wild political twists all operate together to keep you so hooked.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the sheer scale of the world building is just staggering. I mean, to even understand what these characters are fighting for, we have to start with the geopolitical map,
Yeah,
right?
the macro level.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the story takes place in Navarre. It's this kingdom that is entirely hidden behind these massive magical wards, and it's locked in a perpetual centuries-long border war with its neighbor, Poromiel. And it's important to understand the fundamental difference in how these two nations actually fight. Navarre's military might comes entirely from dragon riders.
Yeah.
Poromiel, on the other hand, well, they utilize Griffin
For
riders.
humans, yeah.
Yeah. And because this war has been grinding on for generations, Navarre has basically become a hyper-militarized society. Though for the average citizen safely tucked behind those magical borders, the conflict is really just background noise.
Which brings all the focus to the actual engine of that military, the Bastiath War College. We mentioned that terrifying bridge earlier, the parapet.
Ultimate freshman filter.
Exactly. But the college itself is actually divided into four tracks. You have healers, scribes, infantry, and then the writers' quadrant. And that is where we meet our narrator, Violet Sorengale. Violet is, she's a fascinating protagonist because she is so physically unsuited for the violence of the writers' quadrant.
She really is.
I mean, she's a 20-year-old with a chronic illness. Her joints dislocate easily. She's physically fragile. And she's spent her entire life training to be a peaceful scribe, just surrounded by history books.
Yet her mother, who happens to be the commanding general of the entire Navarre military, just completely upends her life.
Yeah.
She forces Violet into the deadly Riders track. And we have to be really clear about the environment Violet is being shoved into
Yeah,
here.
it's not a joke.
No, the death rate in the Riders Quadrant is not some unfortunate byproduct of intense training. It is an intentional, institutionalized culling process.
The gauntlets they run these kids through are just insane. Like, after you survive the parapet, which again is literally just registration, you have to survive the gauntlet, this brutal, seemingly impossible climbing obstacle course.
And if you make it through all of that physical torture, you finally arrive at threshing. That is the day the dragons actually evaluate the recruits and choose their riders.
Or, they incinerate them because the dragons are not domesticated pets, right? They are ancient, highly intelligent predators.
Exactly. If a recruit approaches a dragon and is deemed, say, unworthy or cowardly, the dragon will simply kill them on the spot.
It's basically the most toxic, high-stakes freshman college orientation ever designed. Like, failing out literally means plummeting to your death or being burned alive. But I think that is exactly why Violet's journey is so compelling for you as a reader. I mean, how does a physically fragile scribe survive an environment designed for ruthless, muscle-bound warriors? She doesn't just, like, suddenly lift a magical sword and become a bodybuilder.
No, not at all. She survives through sheer intellect and adaptation. Violet uses the vast historical and anatomical knowledge she gained from her scribe training to outsmart everyone else.
She gets super resourceful.
Very. When she realizes she can't win in a straight-up hand-to-hand brawl, She researches local flora and begins slipping paralyzing poisons into her opponent's food.
Which is brilliant.
It is. She modifies her uniform and her saddles to accommodate her dislocating joints. She wins by being smarter and, well, better armed.
Which makes her the ultimate underdog, right? And all of that cunning pays off at Threshing in a way that literally breaks the rules of this universe. Because Violet manages to bond not one, but two dragons.
Which is an entirely unprecedented event in Navarre's history. And the contrast between her two dragons tells you a lot about the magic system itself. First, she bonds Tairn. He is a massive, terrifying black Morningstar Tail dragon.
Wait, Morningstar Tail? Like the actual medieval weapon?
Precisely. His tail is literally a lethal spike club. Tairn is one of the oldest, most formidable dragons on the entire continent, but Violet's second bond is the complete opposite. She also bonds Andarna, who just appears to be this little golden feathertail hatchling.
Ah, feathertail.
Right, but feathertails are small, they can't fly well, and they are generally considered completely useless in combat. Most riders wouldn't even give Andarna a second glance.
But bonding these dragons isn't just about having, you know, a cool flying mount. It's about the magic.
Yeah.
Once a rider bonds, the dragon basically channels their magic into the human, and it manifests as a signet.
A unique power, yes.
Yeah, a unique power tailored to the core of who that rider is. And Violet gets a doozy. She gets lightning wielding.
It is an exceptionally rare and devastating signet. It perfectly externalizes the immense destructive strength that Violet has had to keep bottled up inside her fragile physical frame all these years. However, the mechanism of this magic system comes with a, well, a massive, unavoidable complication.
Oh boy, does it.
The dragons do not just grant power, they completely dictate the biological and emotional realities of their riders.
And this is where we have to talk about Zayden Ryerson. Zayden is our romantic lead, and he is a shadow wielder. But more importantly, he is the son of an executed rebellion leader.
The tension is real.
Oh, it's intense. He and Violet start this story as literal blood feud enemies. I mean, her mother killed his father. But, you know, the universe had a sense of humor. Zayden's dragon is Skyul, who is this terrifying navy blue dagger tail. And Skyul just happens to be mated to Tairn, Violet's dragon.
This is the linchpin of the entire narrative. In this lore, when dragons are a mated pair, they share a biological bond so deep that they physically cannot be separated for long periods.
They'll literally die, right?
Yes. If Tairn and Skyul are kept apart, they will suffer immense distress, eventually weaken, and die. And because a rider's life is inextricably tied to their dragon, Violet and Zayden are dragged into that exact same physical dependency.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Are the dragons basically playing geopolitical matchmakers? Like, is this forced proximity just a side effect of the magic system? Or are these ancient, super intelligent creatures intentionally pulling the strings of an enemies to lovers romance?
What's fascinating here is how Yarrows engineers the romance trope directly into the unbending laws of physics for this world.
Yeah.
It's not some contrived situation where two enemies accidentally get locked in a supply closet, you know?
Right. It's not a cheesy sitcom setup.
Yeah. Exactly. The biological reality of the universe dictates that Violet and Zayden must be near each other. They are forced to interact, forced to observe each other's actions, and ultimately forced to confront the biases they hold about one another. It's a brilliant way to organically build trust out of pure, unadulterated hostility.
And trust is in incredibly short supply at Bazgeth, let me tell you. While Violet and Zayden are navigating this messy, dragon-enforced proximity, we slowly uncover the massive geopolitical conspiracy at the heart of the series. Because it turns out everything Violet was taught in the Scribe Quadrant is a lie. Navarre's leadership has been lying for centuries.
The endless border war with the Griffin Riders of Coromiel. It's a carefully constructed smokescreen.
It's completely fake. I mean, the real threat has absolutely nothing to do with Poromiel. The actual enemies are the Venon.
And to understand the Venon, you really have to look at the mechanics of magic in this world. We talked about how dragon riders draw their power through a sentient being, their dragon.
Right, there's a middleman.
Yes. The dragon acts as a conduit and a filter, which naturally limits how much power a human can safely wield. The Venon bypass the dragons entirely. There are humans who choose to draw magic directly from the earth itself.
But there is a horrifying cost to doing that, right?
An immense cost. Drawing raw magic from the earth literally drains the life out of the environment, leaving nothing but barren gray dust behind. Furthermore, it hollows out the soul of the person doing it.
So they lose their humanity.
Completely. It is a pursuit of limitless power that strips away their soul. They even organize themselves into ranks based on their corruption and power levels, starting at Initiate, then Asim, Sage, and at the top, the Maven.
And they don't fight alone, either. The Venon use their stolen Earth magic to create Wyvern, which are these massive, two-legged, completely mindless creatures that basically act as their foot soldiers. They aren't magical beasts like dragons. They're essentially manufactured monsters.
Exactly. The conflict between Riders and Venon is a stark thematic exploration of sustainability versus exploitation. But, you know, the deeper tragedy is how Navarre's leadership responds to this threat.
Oh, this is the part that is just so infuriating. Navarre's leadership knows the Venon exist. They've known for centuries. But instead of, I don't know, uniting the continent to fight them, they just hide behind their magical wards. So Navarre's leaders are basically sitting back, watching the people of Poromiel get slaughtered by earth-draining magic zombies, all to avoid admitting to their own citizens that their history books are a sham.
That is the grim reality. They prioritize the illusion of safety and control over actual human lives. The story shifts drastically here from a magical boarding school survival plot into a really heavy critique of institutional propaganda and information control.
Yeah, totally.
The true villain isn't just the monster outside the wall. It's the corrupt government building the wall and editing the textbooks.
And we see how that institutional corruption poisons personal relationships, too, specifically with Violet's childhood best friend, Dane Eidos. Dane is, well, he's a rule-following, perfectly obedient soldier, and his signet power is incredibly invasive. He can read a person's recent memories just by touching them.
And he has to physically lay his hands on a person's face or temples to do it. It requires a very intimate level of physical contact.
Which makes it so much worse when Violet realizes he has been using this power on her without her consent. Like, he touches her face under the guise of friendship, but he is secretly pulling military intelligence straight out of her mind to report back to leadership. He completely shatters her trust.
Dane's betrayal is really the microcosm of Navarre's entire philosophy. He values the institution, the law, and military hierarchy over basic human autonomy and consent. He genuinely believes that the ends protecting Navarre's secrets justify any means.
It's terrifying. But that exact kind of oppressive surveillance is exactly why the Resistance had to form. And the way the Rebellion manages to operate right under the nose of the Navarre military is wildly clever. It involves a group called the Marked Ones, which brings us right back to Zaydin.
This is perhaps the most intricate piece of world building in the entire series. When Zaydin's father led a rebellion in the province of Tirindor, Navarre's military crushed it mercilessly. They executed all the rebel officers.
But they didn't stop there. They forced the children of those officers, which is 107 kids, including Zaydin, to stand there and watch their parents die. And then, as a permanent punishment, they magically branded all 107 children with a shimmering rebellion relic on their wrists and conscripted them into the deadly Riders Quadrant.
It was meant to be a death sentence and a visible warning, but the crucial detail is how that relic was actually made. The mark was forged by the Fire of Coda, a massive black sword-tailed dragon, and Coda belongs to General Melgrin, the commanding general of all Navarre forces.
Wait, why does it matter whose dragon made the mark?
Because of General Melgrin's signet. He has a terrifying power, precognition. He can magically foresee the exact outcome of any battle before a single sword is even drawn. He's the ultimate strategic weapon, basically allowing Navarre to crush any uprising before it even starts.
But there is a massive loophole in his power. The magic that created those rebellion relics inadvertently created a blind spot. When three or more of those marked children, people like Adin or his friends Liam, Garrick, Bodhi, and Imogen, when three or more of them gather in one place, the overlapping magic of their relics completely blinds General Melgrin's precognition.
It completely shuts him out.
Yeah. He cannot see the outcome of any action they take.
It is a stunning oversight by the military leadership.
It's like they handed these kids an invisible cloak to hide from the magical surveillance state, but it only activates if you're carpooling with at least two other people.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it beautifully illustrates how oppressive systems routinely manufacture the instruments of their own downfall. In their arrogance, by trying to permanently mark and subjugate these children with Coda's magic, Navarre inadvertently handed the rebellion the one specific tool they needed to organize in total secret.
And they absolutely use it, because the jaw-dropping reveal at the end of the first book is that the rebellion is very much alive. In fact, it is being run out of the city of Aricia by Violet's own brother, Brennan. Violet thought Brennan had been dead for 6 years, but he's alive, he's a powerful mentor, you know, a healer, and he's orchestrating the whole resistance.
Finding Brennan alive is the catalyst that finally shatters Violet's remaining loyalty to Navarre. She defects, joining the rebellion, which naturally escalates the narrative directly into the apocalyptic stakes of the sequels.
Which brings us to the absolute chaos of Book 3, Onyx Storm. The secrets are out in the open, the magical wards are failing, and everything is just falling apart. To start, Violet's magic evolves. Because she bonded two dragons, she eventually develops a second signet power, dreamwalking.
Which is classified as mind magic. And in Navarre, any form of mind magic, like manipulating thoughts or walking in dreams, is highly, highly illegal.
Why is it illegal, though? Just because it's dangerous?
Because it cannot be policed or verified. The government relies on absolute control of information. Someone who can enter dreams or manipulate minds threatens the very fabric of their controlled reality. It instantly turns Violet into a criminal by her mere existence.
So she has to hide a fundamental part of her nature, just like Zayden had to hide his rebellion activities. But Violet isn't the only one hiding secrets. We finally get the truth about Andarna, her little golden feather-tailed dragon. She isn't just a late bloomer or some strange black dragon. She is an Irid.
An entirely lost, seventh breed of dragon. The historical text claimed there were only six breeds.
And it turns out the magical wards that protect the entire continent from the Venon actually require the magic of all seven breeds to function properly. So this tiny, underestimated dragon that everyone thought was useless is literally the biological key to saving the world.
It's a wonderful subversion. The establishment constantly dismissed Andarna as weak and irrelevant, yet she is the most essential piece on the entire board.
But even Andarna might not be enough, based on how Onyx Storm ends. We really have to talk about the climax, the Battle of Drathus. The Venon have launched a massive assault. It is an absolute bloodbath. During the chaos, a Venon maven, one of their top generals named Theophany, takes Violet's sister hostage. Violet somehow manages to kill the maven, but the battle is completely falling apart around them.
The stakes reach their absolute peak here. Zayden is watching the battle lines crumble, but more importantly, he is watching his dragon, Snigel, get overpowered. She is about to die, and because a rider's life is tied to their dragon, he is facing the end of everything he loves. So out of sheer desperation, Zayden stops resisting the temptation. He reaches past Slayle, past the dragon bond, and he pulls raw magic directly from the earth.
He turns Venon. He makes the ultimate sacrifice.
He becomes Inasim, the second rank of Venon corruption. By drawing that earth magic, he unleashes a devastating wave of shadow, the Onyx Storm of the book's title, which obliterates the enemy and saves Squale. But the cost is immediate and horrific. He has allowed corruption into his soul. He has become the very monster they have spent three entire books trying to destroy.
And if you think that's rough, the final page of the book is a complete logistical and emotional nightmare. Violet wakes up in Aricia, safe, but she realizes she is completely missing the last 12 hours of her memory.
Just gone.
Completely gone. She looks down at her hand, and there is an emerald ring on her finger. She finds a legally binding marriage document. While we, you know, the reader, we're not watching, she and Zayden got legally married.
Which is actually a brilliant political maneuver. By marrying Zayden, she becomes the Duchess of Tirindor, granting her immense diplomatic immunity and legal protection against Navarre's leadership.
But she doesn't remember doing it. We find out that Violet actually went to her friend Imogen, whose signet power is wiping recent memories, and intentionally asked Imogen to erase those 12 hours from her own mind. She wiped her own memory so that, if she was captured, the enemy couldn't extract Zayden's secrets from her head. But Zayden himself is gone. He vanished into the wind, and all he left behind is this cryptic note that reads, "Don't look for me, it's yours now."
It is an incredibly tragic, devastating twist that fundamentally upends the rules of their entire relationship.
So what does this all mean? I mean, from a purely logistical standpoint, if Violet intentionally had her own memories wiped, how can she possibly trust the situation she woke up in? For that matter, how can she even trust the note Zayden left behind? If he is a Venon now, drawing earth magic, his mind is actively being corrupted. Is that note from the man she loves, or is it a trap laid by a monster?
This raises an important question, and it will undoubtedly be the central conflict of the next book. Can love actually survive literal soul-draining corruption? Zayden made the ultimate sacrifice to save Violet and his dragon, But in doing so, he fundamentally altered his own nature.
Right.
The deep tragedy here is that the political protection he secured for her and the extreme memory wipe she submitted to are both acts of profound, desperate trust. And they are forced to do this in a world where trust has constantly been weaponized against them.
It just leaves you reeling. And we aren't the only ones. Millions of readers are currently agonizing over this exact cliffhanger. Just to give you some real-world context for how massive this is, Rebecca Yarros is planning for this to be a 5-book series.
Yes, a massive undertaking.
Right now, book 4 has no official title and no release date. So if you see rumors flying around online, don't believe them. They are just fan theories. However, there is a companion book called Threshing Day that is officially dropping on September 29th, 2026.
And as with any phenomenon of this scale, the screen adaptation is well underway. A Prime Video TV series is officially in development. They have tapped Meredith Averill, known for her work on The Haunting of Hill House as the showrunner, and Lisa Joy from Westworld is attached to direct the pilot.
There is no cast announced yet, though, so don't fall for the fan casting traps when you're at trivia. But before we let you go, let's leave you with one final unresolved puzzle that Yarros has brilliantly hidden in the architecture of this world. It goes all the way back to the very first rules of the magic system we discussed.
Right. Zayden has vanished at the end of book 3 as a newly corrupted Vinnin. But the established unbreakable law of this universe is that his dragon, Scale, and Violet's dragon, Pairn, are a mated pair.
Right. And if they are kept physically far apart, the dragons will suffer and eventually die, taking their riders with them. So logistically, how far away could Zayden have actually run?
Precisely. Is this biological, magical, forced proximity the one unbreakable tether that might save him? We are looking at a collision of two fundamental laws of magic here. Can the corrupted, earth-draining nature of a Vinnin overpower the ancient biological mating bond of the dragons? Mm. We just don't yet know which force is stronger.
The very mechanic that forced them together as enemies might literally be the only physical law that can drag him back from becoming a monster. That is wild to think about. Well, you are now officially armed with the political history, the dragon lore, and the romantic devastation. You know your feather tales from your Morningstar tales, and you are ready for whatever that trivia night throws at you. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Empyrean series. Until next time, keep your eyes on the skies and watch your step on the parapet.